It is my privilege this morning to introduce our distinguished lecturer, Dr. Eric Routley, and I'm going to take very little of his time. He came to this country as visiting professor of church music at Princeton Theological Seminary in 1975. Prior to that time, he had a distinguished career in England as an educator, a philosopher, a minister, and a musician. He was lecturer in church history at Mansfield College, Oxford. He has been editor of the Congregational Praise and co-editor of many other hymnals. He was president of the Congregational Union in England and Wales in 1970 and 71. And actually, he's no stranger to this country. He gave 11 lecture tours here before he moved to Princeton in 1975. He's currently professor of church music at Westminster Choir College. Two of his 30 books I'd like to call to your attention. My favorite is Hymns and the Faith. You can find copies of most of these books in our library. And his newest book is the Westminster Praise, a small hymnal, which Henshaw Press has published in Chapel Hill. And I think you'll find that very exciting and useful. After you hear Dr. Routley, I'm sure you'll have some questions, and he's eager to engage in dialogue with you, and will do so at 11 o'clock in the Commons Room. Those of you who do not have a class will be anxious to meet him there. And I'm sure he means just what he says. He'll answer any questions you choose to ask. Just be prepared to accept his answers when he gives them. We're delighted to welcome Dr. Routley.
No, my dear sir. What I normally say is, when asked to answer questions, that I will answer them, but you need not trust the answers. Allow me to say how delighted and honored I feel at being invited to this distinguished and, as I now see, beautiful campus at Wake Forest. I'm very unsure whether I can be the least use to any of you. I wasn't at all sure what I ought to say. I was fairly clear about some things that I ought not to say, and so I decided at first to say those. But we haven't met before, so I shall have to feel my way. What I am most interested in is asking theological questions about music. In other company, I might even ask musical questions about theology. Don't think I would dare do that here. But being essentially an amateur in both fields, I feel that the use of music in church is, amongst so many of us, an activity about which we never do ask any questions at all. We just assume that it will happen. Music is as much to be assumed in the church as the pulpit, or the organ, or the pews. And it may be some time since we asked the question, what the pulpit's for. But I would guess that it was a longer time since we asked the question, what the music's for. I want to make you, if I can, a little uncomfortable about this. I would rather you asked questions and then provided your own more intelligent answers than that you totally accepted such answers as I want to give, however tentative they are. And the older one gets, the more tentative one is about answers, because the older you get, the more you have learnt, and therefore the more often you have been proved wrong. But I would rather you started thinking and provided your answers, because I know that in that communion, which I imagine is mostly represented here, music always plays a very large part in worship. Now, there is music in Christian worship of every kind, except, I think, only that of the English Society of Friends, the Quakers, who in England still, at their meetings for worship, use no music, but then they don't have any sermons either, so they're very eccentric, or you would think so. But apart from that, there is music in all Christian worship. Let us remind ourselves what was its original purpose, what it was doing there. It seems very clear that as soon as there were Christian songs. I think the scriptures leave us in no doubt about that. I don't suppose they sang very well, but they had to sing. The earliest Christians, of course, came from a tradition in which music was used in worship, the music of the Psalms in the synagogue. I suspect, however, that in the earliest Christian meetings, all those present might very likely join in, at any rate part of what was sung, which was not true, as you will, I'm sure, know, in the synagogue to which they'd been accustomed. I think it very likely, and I gather this from that most fascinating chapter in St. Paul, which I shall be referring to again, the 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, I gather that if anybody had composed a song, he would come along and sing it. And since their worship was both very fervent and also very informal, it is perfectly possible that there were bits of these songs in which everybody could join. Books, of course, were virtually unknown. And that is why, in the singing of the Psalms in the synagogue to which the earliest Christians had been used, it was all solo music with very occasionally a gospel song with a chorus, like Psalm 136. And that's what that is, with a chorus at the end of every verse. But in the ordinary way, only one voice would sing and the rest would listen. To some extent, that must have been true with early Christian worship. But when Paul says, when you come to your meeting, every one of you brings an experience or a teaching or a song, clearly, Christians said at once, the new thing for us is the resurrection of Christ, we must sing about it. And the New English Bible, I don't know if that is regarded as a heretical book in these sacred precincts, but in the New English Bible, at Ephesians 5:14, the words, "Awake thou that sleepest and arise from the dead," are introduced by the words, "as the hymn says." If that is a conjecture safe enough to include in an actual text of the scriptures, the conjecture is that there were already, by the time Ephesians was written, do you believe Paul wrote it? I do hope he did. Though I know there are some scholars who said he can't have. Well, it doesn't contain an account of his own death, so perhaps it's reasonably safe to believe he did. Well, never mind who did write it. Clearly, Christians already had a little handful of hymnody, perhaps, which they knew in Ephesus. You see, you could quote one, and you could expect people to know it. Well, very well. There was church music, so to put it, in those furtive and triumphant meetings of the primitive Christians. But what was the music? I'm talking about music. The music was of the simplest possible kind. There was only enough music in it to make it a serviceable vehicle for the words. And you know, for 1500 years, this was how the church regarded music. At any rate, for the first 1200 years of the Christian era, the music made in church was music whose purpose was no more than to make the words audible. Christian churches in the Middle Ages tended to center, at any rate, upon very large and beautiful and well-staffed buildings which were part of enormous campuses scattered over Europe that we call monasteries. Buildings the size of this or greater, rather than little local ones. They sang the scriptures because that was how you would get the scriptures heard. They didn't have public address systems in those days. The choir sang the Psalms to Gregorian plainsong because that was a very good way of keeping them together. In their weekday services, though not in their Sunday services, they would occasionally sing hymns to plainsong. And the plainsong music, again, was simply there in order to give the words a vehicle. There was no question of music expressing emotion or anything of that sort. The simpler it was, the better it appealed to the church authorities. As soon, however, as music becomes clever, as soon as revolutionary devices such as more than one voice singing at the same time, more than one part being heard at the same time, several tunes going on, even different words being sung at the same time, as soon as all that kind of music developed, at once the authorities of the church asked questions whether it should be allowed to. Whether music was not already becoming too clever. Whether it was likely to distract people's attention from the words it was setting. There is no music yet in church that is not associated with words. They asked these questions. They said, there are certain musical devices which we do not approve, certain musical forms which should not be used in church, and they issued documents and edicts to this effect, of which the musicians took no notice whatever. And from that time, from about the 14th century onwards, music and theology were on opposite sides of a barrier, exactly as they are in this building of yours. I came into this building 10 minutes before 10 o'clock, and the first thing I saw, to my delight, was the organist. Naturally, I walked straight up here to try and make contact with the organist. That is not possible. You must go out of the building again and in again if you want to proceed from the place where the word is preached to the place where the word is sung. I don't know if any of you have noticed this, but that is a symbol of exactly what I'm interested in, or interested in protesting against. Because you do not believe that the ministry of music and the ministry of the word are in any sense related, except in that they happen to be taking place in the same building. Or the ministers of music and the ministers of the word would be able to enter the church by the same door. something about that. I mean, if I have the effect of somebody coming here at 2 o'clock in the morning with a saw and some hinges and a plane and... Let me do it decently. Do it nicely. But for Pete's sake, that seems to me to be exactly what shouldn't happen in church. Because I know what has to happen when you're starting a service. Whoever is preaching has got to come in one way, and whoever's singing has got to come in the other way. Now, that started in the 14th century, and it's time you woke up. Yes, you see, I don't know whether it was you people who coined the expression minister of music. It is an expression we don't use in England, and one I've always rather liked. It's an expression used in other Christian communions, I know, over here. But it really was believed in those earliest days of the church that the choir was a kind of clergy. That there was only a very fine line, only a line of function, not a line of essence between the musicians and the ministers. Now they're very far apart. Now they're threatening each other. Now if one of them is particularly good at his or her job, the other one is going to feel threatened. And it's because of this kind of architecture that that is so. Now, let us talk a little more about clever music. About music, as it has developed so that it's the sort of material we use now, music which can be listened to as well as sung words to or danced to. In the earlier days, in the first 1500 years, music really was either for carrying words or for dancing. It was either to use your mind with or to use your body with. And since the church was terrified of bodies, and well it might be, because in the Middle Ages, they were a nuisance. I mean, your life expectancy was 27 years. The body really did threaten practically everything else there. Something was always going wrong with it, and nobody knew what to do about it. You either lived to be about 20, or you lived to be about 100, because you were too tough to kill. But since the church felt like that, dancing, of course, was out, and any kind of music that sounded like a dance had to be played outside church. The music that was sung inside church was associated with words and words only. It was not to be heard by itself. But now, in our own time, there is a great deal of music. In fact, many people would argue the greatest kind of music is the sort of music that stands by itself and that is in itself a complete language. Now, if music is a language and theology is another language, how are they to run in decent harmony with each other? Now, you see, this is where one has to introduce the important and yet very obvious statement that all music in church is music which is done either in the presence of or by people who are not musical. All Baptists are musical. I imagine that you can't get into a Baptist seminary without being. So it will be bad news for you to hear that you can get into heaven without being musical. It's going to be a big surprise, of course, for anybody who is unmusical, because I gather that there's an awful lot of music going on there. So something presumably has to be done in order to make unmusical people musical enough to enjoy heaven when they get there. And I suppose that's what purgatory is all about. But here below, as the hymn writers so love to say, we have to put up with the situation that not everybody who comes into church is musical. We don't ask them for their musical qualifications before admitting them to membership. All right, now then, music for unmusical people is something very different from what it is for musical people. Music can be a pleasure, but it can be a pollution. And it's the unmusical people who notice this. Music as a pollution is, of course, a disagreeable aspect of modern civilization. Horrible jukeboxes, Muzak, Hammond organs being played in bars. Went to a very nice restaurant around here, there's a poor fellow playing a Hammond organ. Well, I don't know what he's done to be condemned to playing so abominable as instruments as that. To people who would just as soon not hear any sounds at all, but get on eating their meal. That's a pollution. But there are people who dislike every kind of music. Somehow or other, the church has to minister to people like that and assume that they are going to be present. And it then becomes absolutely clear, and this, I think, is a theological judgment, at any rate it's a pastoral one. It becomes absolutely clear that if music trespasses so far into public worship that its importance and its effect and its impressiveness are clearly much greater than those of the words, then it's becoming a pollution. Now, let me explain this. You who are musical understand the vocabulary. You understand the language. This is because you have a sort of built-in critical filter. It's been developed and trained either naturally or professionally, so that you can at once distinguish between music that's got to be taken seriously and music that can be ignored. Now, you know that music, as we've got it, is now an exceedingly expressive medium of communication. It can arouse and generate all manner of emotions, from great cheerfulness to profound depression. Music can do this, and it can do it to you, but you know why it is doing it now. Suppose you expose a congregation of people, most of whom have not got this critical filter, to music, which is going to have a noticeable emotional effect on them, but an effect that they cannot resist because they have no critical filter, then you are brainwashing those people. If the music is not still quite clearly the servant of the words, then that is liable to happen. When I speak to you tomorrow, if any of you are here, I want to talk very much more about words. I want to tell you what you ought to be sharing with your people. But I'm now talking about music, which for so many people is capable of drowning words. So that if the words are beautiful or sensitive or fresh or trenchant or alarming, by the time they've been sung to another tune that's just the same as all the other tunes, the words are going to sound just the same as all the other words. You can brainwash people by insisting that only one style of music shall ever be used in your worship. You can brainwash people by saying, we will use this kind of music because it will calm them down, or it will cheer them up, or it will have some effect on those people that you wish to produce. Who do you think you are? Let me be technical in the second place. That was about the critical filter, the vulnerability of ordinary people to the perverted skill of people who wish to pervert music, to the Hitlers of this world, to the tyrants who wish to get a crowd of people on their side, and they know that they will do it by making them sing heartily. That's something to watch, but let me be technical. Music, as we understand it, music of the kind that we normally use in church, has two elements. One is reason, the other is rhetoric. That is to say, it has exactly the same two elements as any sermon, as any preaching of the word. It is the same kind of communication in that there is reason and there is rhetoric. There is the rational structure that makes it possible to communicate at all. There is the rhetoric, the rhythm, the tune that makes the communication acceptable. You are pure and unspotted from the world, so I would have to tell you that there are preachers whose preaching is entirely rational and not at all rhetorical, so that splendid stuff though it is, it's as boring as old boots because nobody wants to listen to it. The man can't put it over. There are also preachers, and this you will not know either, whose preaching is entirely rhetoric, who are saying nothing whatever and saying it marvelously. So that everybody says, wasn't he beautiful? Of course, he has to be that. It's just like that with music. You can see it there on the page. You can see that on any page of your hymn book, there's some music at the top and there's some music at the bottom of any given system of music. Usually got four notes. And there's one up there, and then two in the middle that you can needn't worry about, and another one down at the bottom. And the notes at the bottom are the reason, the bass. And the notes at the top are the tune that people hear. So they're the rhetoric. And you can have tunes that in which the bass is admirable and the top part is unexceptionable, and yet the whole thing is rather dull. You can have tunes in which the top part is tremendously exciting and the bottom part uses only three different notes. And there's a lot of rhetoric without any reason. You can have tunes in which both of them are thoroughly efficient, and you can see it with, as it were, the naked eye. You can see a good movement in bass and in treble, then you've got the two working together. Then you've got it like a preacher who has something to say and can say it, who is not only speaking attractively, but also speaking the truth. Now, if you want to be theological about music, you've got to say that kind of thing. I could point you, but this is not the place to do it because I want you to do your own thinking, to plenty of music in this hymnal that you use, which is of all three kinds. There's some very dull music there. There's some desperately over-rhetorical brainwashing music there. And there is some fine material, which is what the church really ought to be using. And you can tell for yourself which kind it is. But thirdly, if I've spoken about the critical filter, and I've spoken a little bit technically, only to demonstrate to you that this can be rationally demonstrated about how music can brainwash, then thirdly, I think I need to say something about what I note in many churches as what I call the music sprawl. One of the delightful and splendid things about the United States is the way in which church music is taken seriously. In which it is a professional discipline. Well, I wouldn't be here myself if it hadn't been like that. I'm teaching a subject at Westminster that there would be no chance of my ever teaching in England. So if you want to get people like me to go home, you'd better start being a little less musically efficient. But what I do notice is, and I come back to this wretched barrier, this awful piece of wood behind me. I'm not referring to Dr. Johnson, I'm referring to the... if I may come back to that, music and the gospel going along parallel routes but never meeting. And I have two examples that I want to give of this, one of which will be offensive. But the one you won't mind, because it comes from very much another part of the country and another Christian culture, is the kind of thing that I've seen in churches where there is a very large musical establishment. Several members of the music faculty in the church, several choirs, lots doing, all got up like dogs' breakfasts in blue and pink and heaven knows what, and they think a great deal of themselves. So that when you walk in singing the processional hymn, which may be of three stanzas, there is an organ interlude lasting 3 minutes between stanza two and stanza three. This is disproportionate. What are the poor creatures in the congregation going to do while the organist is cavorting about like that? And organ interludes can be magnificent, provided they do not modulate into the next key higher, which is an appalling custom of the pop culture that I don't like to see happening in church. Interludes, free accompaniments, you name it, can be admirable and effective and inspiring, but not on that scale, for Pete's sake. Taking rather longer than the whole hymn takes to sing. During the taking up of the collection, which is always regarded as an activity so indecent that it must be covered with music, you will find that it takes like 2.5 minutes to take up the collection and 7 minutes to sing the anthem that is being sung while it's being taken up. Why all that music? What's it all doing? You will really think that I loathe music. I don't, not really. There's a lot of music I like very much, but I'm always thinking of that unmusical person in the church for whom music is an interruption of the gospel, is something that they didn't come to church to get. Now, that unmusical person, simply because the critical filter isn't there and they're not asking questions, they are capable of greater innocent enjoyment, just as they are capable of greater bewilderment and misery than the musical. And if these things are done with due proportion, with a sense of how long that's going to take, with a sense of what is going to fit rationally and kindly into the rest of the worship. If these things are done, the unmusical people are up on their feet singing like nobody's business. The one way to get good hymn singing is to have good hymn choosing. There can be no question about that. And of course, good playing of them on whatever instrument you've got. Now, so often I find that the musician, the keen, dedicated, committed musician, has no idea how much complaint they are arousing in the congregation simply because they're doing it beautifully so far as the music's concerned, but out of proportion, uncooperatively, simply because that barrier is there and nobody has talked to anybody else. Well, now, I say that, and I think that this is a lack of congruence, you see, between music and the gospel. There are large pieces of music that will hold up an ordinary church service. I want to hear them sometime, but make another occasion for it. But now look at this. Suppose that I hear a preaching service in which the preacher has spoken biblically and rationally and gracefully and humbly, has spoken in such a way that I will now be a member of the congregation, and I will be as untheological as I am unmusical, as rebellious anyway. I don't want to be pushed around by this fellow. Who does he think he is, preaching what he thinks is the gospel? And in spite of all my resistance, he's sold it to me. And he's shown me something I didn't know. And he's brought me really into the presence of the intolerable beauty of God. And then suppose that what follows musically is a sound played on an electronic instrument with continuous use of a device that sends that instrument out of tune, called a chorus generator, and another device that sends that instrument out of tune called the tremulant. So that after the incisive, poetic precision of what has been said, the music is approximate, vulgar, and altogether corrupt. Now, when that happens, what am I to say? Do I not see again a lack of congruence between the gospel and the music? This happens. There's no point in disguising the fact that I know that it happens in very large scale public worship indeed. The larger the scale, the more likely it is that the music will be of that kind. And I particularly stress the purely mechanical point, that the instrument is deliberately put out of tune by the pressing of a button and the turning of a lever before you start singing whatever the hymn's going to be. Now, the gospel is supposed to be modest and dangerous. If the music is pompous and flatulent, what has that music to do with the gospel? Well, I call these theological questions. And so I come back in the end to that from which I started out. Music is a kind of communication. Music has to be used with great care. Music has to be used by people who have a sense of the ministry, and not only of professional music, because it has to be used in order to comfort and reassure and chasten unmusical people. But, bless us all, you have no right to use the kind of music that will drive a musical person screaming from your sanctuary. Oh, I'm not saying. I am very emphatically, and I hope eloquently, not saying that you've got to play down to corrupt taste. You have to minister to innocence, not corruption. I am sometimes asked when I talk like this, oh, then, are you only interested in educated people coming to church? It is the uneducated people who love all this bad music. And I say, good heavens, no. But I can do nothing for anybody who is not educable. And neither can you. And if anybody comes into church saying, I expect the church to tell me nothing new and nothing alarming, I expect the church to tell me all the things that I have already known and to tell me that during the past week I have been doing fine. Why then those people are like the people in the Exodus who, when Moses had got them out of their concentration camps in Egypt, and when they found themselves short of food or water or anything else, always said, take us back to prison.